Who can say where the killer roams? When the blood flows, it's slaying time. Slay away. Slay away. Slay away.
Behind your favorite horror films, lore, gore, and every kill in between. On this episode, we'll be discussing the holiday horror film Black Christmas, directed by Bob Clark and released theatrically on December 20th, 1974.
High school girl's been murdered. Mr. Harrison's daughter is missing. And now at the house where she lives, the other girls are getting obscene phone calls.
Yeah, what I've done is I've tapped this phone so that when it rings, it'll ring at the station house too.
There was a little girl murdered over in the park tonight.
Yes, I heard.
Your phone's ringing.
Terminal 55.
Remember those idyllic scenes out of your childhood? Crisp winter nights, star bright, sleigh bells, crackling Yule logs, candlelight glistening off of shimmering Christmas trees, chestnuts roasting over open fires, carolers beneath snow-covered window ledges. Remember those? Remember them well. After Black Christmas, they'll never be the same again. Black Christmas, starring Olivia Hussey, Keir Dulley, Margot Kidder, and starring John Saxon as Lieutenant Fuller. If this movie doesn't make your skin crawl, it's on too tight.
So, I have some special guests with me, and let's get introductions out of the way. I've got Ten Baki here, no stranger to the Slayaway podcast, and Alistair, who's here for the first time.
Hi, yeah, I'm Ten Baki. I'm a writer and a musician and a producer, and I'm just going to leave it at that, yeah.
Hello, I'm Alistair Sharkwater. I'm a co-host of Evil by Default podcast, and I'm also a moderator on Scener.
So are you both ready to chat horror with me today? I'm super excited to be discussing this. I've been wanting to talk about this film for a while.
Of course, I'm super excited. And I also found out a fun fact about this, but we'll talk about that later.
Oh, yes, we will. We're going to talk about all of the fun facts, I promise. Before we get into it, I do want to ask, Ten, how did you discover your love of horror?
Oh, my gosh. Well, like, I liked horror growing up when I was younger. I liked, like, weird, creepy stuff, and I would, like, ask to get the little Spawn collectibles when I was a kid. I was like, I need those. They're so cool. But I would say that, like, I really got more into it when I was a little bit older, after I graduated high school. I remember seeing Dead Alive for the first time, and it just blew my mind. And I was like, this is the best thing I've ever seen in my life. And I basically dived into horror like pretty hard after that and started watching every film possible and collecting everything. And then, I don't know, I guess within the last few years, I started writing about it and talking about it. And I, you know, that's where I'm at now.
Alistair, what about you?
Oh, my love of horror. It started with the show Are You Afraid of the Dark? It would play every Saturday on Nickelodeon, and it just blew my mind. And also from that, I went to watching Monster Vision on TNT, and that just introduced me to a lot of the classics.
Before we jump into talking more about Black Christmas, I actually want to ask you both about what your favorite holiday horror film is and why it's your favorite. So, Ten, I'm going to start with you.
I don't know if I've ever really thought about it. My favorite holiday horror film. Well, first of all, let me say every year on Christmas, I have a tradition. I watch Gremlins. So that's got to be up there. And I consider it horror. There's some horror stuff in that movie. You know what I mean? Like, but, you know, loosely, okay, if you want to be more specific about horror, I guess, honestly, it might be Black Christmas, the 1974 version. I watch it every December. It's a great film and one of the best, if not the best slasher of all time, in my opinion. It's so good.
So I would definitely classify Gremlins as a horror film. It 100% is. It's a horror comedy, right? So Alistair, what's your favorite holiday horror film?
Ever since Joe Bob Briggs says this was a Christmas horror movie, that's been my choice. So my pick is Phantasm. Mainly, also because the silver balls the tall man used to attack people look like Christmas ornaments, but it's also one of my favorite horror movies in general. Mainly in use of how it uses dream logic. Like even more, like Nightmare on Elm Street has the villain attack people in dreams, but this is structured like a main character will fall asleep and wake up in the lair of the bad guy. It's like it just like a story edits like that and with no explanation given. It's very, very much structured like a dream.
Very cool. Now, I'm going to admit that I haven't seen Phantasm. It's been on my watch list for a really long time. Don't give me any flack, but I will get there. I'll get to it, I promise. That's definitely one thing that's great about the horror community. I'm finding new horror films to watch every day. My watch list is just getting longer and longer and longer. And then with the help of Letterboxd, I kind of am able to keep everything in order to know what have I watched? What have I not watched? What did I think, etc. Let's jump into talking about Black Christmas. So a little introduction here. As winter break begins, A group of sorority sisters, including Jess, played by Olivia Hussey, and the often inebriated Barb, played by Margot Kidder, begin to receive anonymous, lascivious phone calls. The caller, dubbed the Moaner by the sorority sisters, has been calling the girls for some time. Initially, Barb goads the caller on, but stops when he responds threateningly.
Hello? 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 Hey, quiet! It's him again! The Moaner!
Expanded his act. Could that be one person? No, Claire, that's the Mormon Tabernacle Choir doing their annual obscene phone call. They could use a little of this.
You piggy cunt. You want my fat cock too?
Oh, why don't you go find a wall socket and stick your tongue in it? That'll give you a charge.
I'll stick my tongue up your pretty pussy.
You fucking creep!
I'm going to kill you.
Soon afterward, sorority sister Claire, played by Lynn Griffin, goes missing from the sorority house, and a local adolescent girl is murdered in the park, leading the girls to suspect a serial killer is on the loose. However, no one realizes just how near the killer really is. So Black Christmas is probably one of the most significant Canadian horror films of all time. So it's now considered a classic of both the holiday and horror genres alike. The film was also a major cinematic benchmark for slasher films as we've grown to know them. The film was at first a screenplay by Roy Moore called The Babysitter, which riffed on the now familiar urban legend of a babysitter tormented by a killer who turns out to be making phone calls from inside the house. Moore was inspired by the urban legend The Babysitter and the Man Upstairs and a series of murders that took place in the Westmount neighborhood of Montreal, Quebec. So the concept was then reworked by Timothy Bond as a frightful experience with college students and eventually made its way to director Bob Clark. Clark kickstarted his film career in the United States with low-budget films like Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things. Not something I've seen, but is that something that either of you had heard of before?
Yes. And also, Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things is pretty good. It's like,
okay, so you have seen it.
Yeah,
it's like I added it to my watch list.
Yeah, no, it's pretty good. I've seen it before. I you know, like Bob Clark is the kind of director that has like movies like this one, like Black Christmas and A Christmas Story, and like I don't know, like, and like Porky's and stuff. So we're like, when I go to name his movies, I would never say like Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things, like, oh, that's the one, just because he has so like iconic like films. But it is genuinely a really good film, and I quite enjoyed it.
Well, the script was retitled Stop Me and underwent another evolution once Clark got a hold of it. He dialed back the murder sequences, believing that they were too violent, and added various dialogue to emphasize the adultness of college students, including the scenes in which Barb is drunkenly ranting about turtles having sex, which is, I think, one of the main comedic scenes in the film, if you could say that there's any. There's actually quite a bit of comedy in it. So he also introduced the idea that the film would never actually show the killer to the audience. The film's now famous mysterious killer concept is a very well-known trope, and we'll talk a lot more and discuss all of the genre-defining tropes in the film in a little bit. Let's step into a segment we like to call Creep Me Out, where we explore the true events and lore that inspired the film. As previously mentioned, Roy Moore's screenplay was inspired by the urban legend The Babysitter and the Man Upstairs, and a string of murders in the Westmount area of Montreal. As far as the true crime inspiration for the film's story is concerned, the series of murders were committed by serial killer Wayne Beaudin. Beaudin was a charming 26-year-old from Montreal who always left bite marks on the breasts of his victims. All of his victims were found naked and strangled to death. Beaudin shares some striking similarities with Ted Bundy, which may be why people often associate the film with Bundy's crimes. A sexual sadist obsessed with the desire to bite female breasts, Beaudin became infamous as the vampire rapist after his distinctive trademark. He stalked his victims in the neighborhood of Montreal, sparking a 2-year reign of terror with attacks that drew particular attention for their brutality. Investigators looked into who the women had been dating, and the name Bill kept coming up. Police even had a photograph of the suspect. The big break in the case came when colleagues at the school where his fifth and final victim was a teacher reported that she had been seen with a young man in a blue Mercedes on the night she perished. The car featured a bowl-shaped decal advertising beef in the window. A friend of the victim also recalled that she was seeing a man named Bill. The final confirmation of Beaudin's guilt was delivered by an orthodontist who was able to demonstrate 29 points of similarity between the bite marks on the women and Beaudin's teeth. He was convicted of multiple life sentences for the murders of Norma Villancourt, Shirley Audette, Marielle Archambault, Jean Ray, and Elizabeth Fortius from 1968 to 1972. Thankfully, not many similarities were lifted from Beaudin's murders and the story we see in the fictionalized film. Now, let's jump into the urban legend, because there's a lot to talk about there. So we all know this urban legend. It's pretty familiar to everyone. The Babysitter and the Man Upstairs, also known as the Babysitter or the Sitter, is an urban legend that dates back to the 1960s about a teenage girl babysitting children who receives telephone calls from a stalker who continually asks her to check the children. The basic storyline has been adapted a number of times in films. I think probably the one that we'll recognize best is When a Stranger Calls, which came out 5 years after Black Christmas. The 1950 murder of teenage babysitter Janet Christman is commonly cited as a source of the legend. The legend details a teenage girl who is watching television at night while babysitting after the children have been put to bed upstairs. The phone rings. The unknown caller tells her, "Check the children." The girl dismisses the call, but the anonymous caller dials back several times and the girl becomes increasingly frightened. Eventually, the babysitter calls the police, who inform her they will trace the next call. After the stranger calls again, the police return her call, advising her to leave immediately. She evacuates the home, and the police meet her to explain that the calls were coming from inside the house and that the unidentified prowler was calling her after killing the children upstairs. There are a lot of different variants of this story, and I think we've heard them all. This is how urban legends work. The story changes as it passes from one person to the next. There is one version where the children are with the babysitter while watching television. The prowler starts phoning them, saying that he'll be with them in a decreasing amount of time. And then after they get the news that the calls are coming from inside the house, they hear a door upstairs opening and then the sound of footsteps heading towards the room where they are. This version can actually be found in the Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark books. So this is something that's had an impact throughout time from a lot of different places. And then in films, it's been used in a lot of places as well, not just Black Christmas. It's been used in Foster's Released, The Severed Arm, The Sitter from 1977, When a Stranger Calls from 1979, When a Stranger Calls Back from 1993, The Black Christmas remake in 2006, the remake of When a Stranger Calls in 2006 as well. And there's When a Killer Calls, also from 2006, and Amusement from 2008. So a lot of different films that you can check out that utilize this trope. So anything else you want to talk about before we jump into a little bit about the backstory and reception of the film?
Can we talk about how great Margot Kidder is, or do you want to leave that for a little later?
You can talk about Margot Kidder now.
Okay, I'm going to say best drunk. I don't know if she went method with it. I know some actors do, but best drunk performance I have ever seen.
Margot Kidder is great. I agree. One of the things I like about Margot Kidder's performance in this movie specifically is not only is it like a really truly believable like drunken person, they also are so intricate. Like at first, I just hate them. Like the things they say are horrible and I don't like their character at all. And I'm like, wow, you're just the worst person ever. But then like there's that moment when they're really drunk after the turtle scene that you were just talking about, where she like breaks and like she's like, you all think it's my fault because I was mean to her, like it's my fault that she's dead. And like, and you could tell like there's like that little bit of like sincerity of like she's actually saying that she's blaming herself for it. And it's just a really, really good performance. Genuinely love her in this movie. Honestly, genius and great writing too. Bob Clark adding that stuff in, making her character like more interesting, definitely changed the whole vibe of the film. Also, what's her name? Miss Quay, like headmaster or whatever. She's also really funny, where she like hides alcohol in books and in toilets and stuff.
Oh yes, so we could talk a little bit about Marion Waldman as Mrs. Mack. She is the house mother for the sorority, and she is also she's a drunk, right? She's obviously an alcoholic, but she's a very high functioning drunk. And yeah, she hides liquor all over the house. There's liquor. She's like, and it's the way that she like doesn't remember where she's hidden her liquor. She's always surprised by where she finds it. And I'm like, did the girls hide it there as contraband, or is she finding it because she hid it there?
I definitely was under the impression that she was hiding it. Like the one where she's like looking through the books and she's like, oh, let's see, BBBB for booze. And she like pulls out like a drink. I'm like they cut out in the book. Like that's not like, you don't hide contraband like in a cutout book, like in a, you know, like in her room, basically.
Maybe it was totally in the hers. 70s. Cause I think that might've been a common area. So I actually think it's the girls' stashes, because under sorority bylaws, you shouldn't have that stuff in the house. I think it actually is a bylaw thing, and that maybe it's the girl's contraband versus her contraband. Like some of it might be hers, but I think that I initially was under the impression that it was the girl's contraband.
That's so interesting, because I always thought she was hiding it from the girls, like that was her stash.
I think you could actually view it either way. It works both ways, and it's very interesting in either scenario, and it's fun to toy with. So I like that a lot.
Either way, she has a problem.
Oh yeah.
Well, yeah, that's obvious. That obviously she has a drinking problem, but it's something that adds to the comedic value of her character, in my opinion, because I think she's meant to alleviate high tension in certain moments throughout the film.
Yeah, like there's the scene where the dad goes to the house and he's like looking around like, oh, like, you know, Claire never, you know, showed up today and I'm nervous about it. And like just having Miss Mack there, like it was just so funny, because she's like, oh, better cover up this nude poster on the wall. Like it's just so goofy.
Talking a little bit about the backstory and reception of the film, upon its release, Black Christmas received mixed reviews, but it has since received critical praise amongst film historians, noting it for being one of the earliest slasher films. It also is praised for its influence on John Carpenter's Halloween that was released in 1978. And aside from earning a cult following since its release, a novelization was also written by Lee Hayes and published in 1976. The film is also the first in the Black Christmas film series, followed by two remakes in 2006 and 2019. The film has since received retroactive recognition and has been regarded as one of the greatest horror films ever made. So obviously we agree with 10 there, but I thought it was interesting how this spoke about it being the first in the series of films as if they're sequels or something. Like the 2006 film is a direct remake while the 2019 film is a reimagining.
Yes, a reimagining versus a remake. The age-old question, or like, is it a sequel that takes place in the same universe? Like, I love it when they do that with remakes.
Well, I love that the 2006 film is very much in the vein of all those like really not so great horror films that came out in the early 2000s. Even though, I mean, it's 2006, so I guess we could call it the late 2000s. But that was among Mary Elizabeth Winstead's Scream Queen films back in the day.
Oh, that's right. She was in that.
Yeah. And then the 2019 film, which I'm going to go with reimagining because I saw it for the first time about 2 weeks ago. And I was like, this is not Black Christmas at all. This is a totally different film, so I'm not sure why they even named it Black Christmas. It takes a lot of the inspiration and premise of that film, but it flips it on its head. It becomes a whole supernatural thing. It has absolutely nothing to do with the original concept. It's completely different. So I think they should have called it something else.
I have not seen the 2019 one, so you spoiled it for me on the supernatural. I'm kidding. It's
Sorry.
Fine. No, it's fine. It's like 3 years old now. It's fine. It's about to be 2022. It's my own fault.
Well, just wait, because if you do watch it, when I say supernatural influences, that's just my impression of what went on throughout this film. So you watch it and you let me know what you think. But I really want to get into talking before we even get into like walking through the film, the genre defining tropes that Black Christmas gave us. So who's ready to talk about those?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Let me just say, I know that you're saying that this film gets credit, but I don't think it gets enough credit. It's really, really good, and it's so iconic, and it did so many things so early on. I'm not going to sit here and argue, like, you know, logistics over, like, Psycho being a slasher or whatever, like, you know, and get into that. But if we look at, like, the like, huge change of film in the 80s and horror with, you know, Friday the 13th and whatever, just Nightmare and just any of the slashers that are popular from that time, like, this was so much earlier. And even when I think of like the phone call tropes too, like When a Stranger Calls was like 5 years after this movie, like, and that, yes, is like, gets so
we're
much
gonna get
credit
into all those. I actually want to read a little bit from this article called Black Christmas Was the First Halloween. And it's from a online publication called The Ringer. And the article itself is by Jason Concepcion. And so it was published in 2018. Black Christmas director Bob Clark's 1974 film is a slasher classic, as we all know. Clark, who passed away in 2007, is a fascinating figure. Who else can credibly claim to have invented the teen sex comedy in Porky's, the modern nostalgic Christmas movie in A Christmas Story, the graffiti action thriller Turk 182, which I have not seen, and then the modern slasher with Black Christmas. It's a pioneering genre film. So if you've seen a slasher film, almost any slasher film, you've likely seen the tropes that Black Christmas created. Nowhere is the film's influence more obvious, Jason says, than in 1978's Halloween. And I actually had never put this together before because I had seen Halloween long before I saw Black Christmas. Black Christmas actually made three very crucial contributions to the genre, and it was the first horror film that used a very extremely dated scenario now, as 10 was mentioning, which is the call is coming from inside the house, right? So this device was later made popular by When a Stranger Calls, and that was in 1979. So actually not quite as, that's 5 years, right, Ten? That's what you're saying?
Yeah, I said it was 5 years that went by.
So, and then it was repackaged for a new generation in Scream, which came out in 1996. Black Christmas was also the first film to introduce the concept of the identityless killer. So a killer with no public facing facade and no motive save for a desire to commit gruesome murders or crimes. And that was really interesting. And then that also occurs in Halloween. So even though we do have a face for Michael Myers when the mask is taken off the six-year-old, we don't. And we do see a face at the end of the film that's very much influenced and used in Halloween. So most importantly, though, Black Christmas was the first slasher film to depict events from the killer's first-person perspective. So aside from the killer not really having an identity or a face or a motive or anything like that, we see all of these first-person perspectives from them looking into the house, to them at the front door, to them climbing the trellis into the attic. And we see everything from their point of view, which is really interesting. So let's talk about some of these tropes. And Tan, I'm going to let you take the lead.
It's kind of just echoing what you were saying and even what I was saying before. It just did so much for the first time. I heard you mention when you're reading its impact on later films like Scream. And while like I agree, because like obviously it impacted all the films that made Scream happen, I think it's kind of hard to give it that much credit for Scream because it's so much later that at that point, you know, Scream's parodying even like Halloween and stuff like that and has like shot for shot stuff.
Right. And I think they're speaking specifically about the calls coming inside the house, like the opening sequence and the Sydney sequence. I mean, the calls are always coming from inside the house and Scream until we get to later on, I think, technically, for the most part. wait, if I think about it, but I don't think it can take credit for everything going on in Scream.
No, absolutely, absolutely. I wasn't, saying that that writer was wrong. I was just saying that I give that one a little bit more, like, space. Just because, like, as time passed, no one was thinking, oh, this trope is from this movie. Like, after a while, people are just like, oh, that's what they all do, you know? I mean, but with Halloween, that POV, the opening shot, like, I know it looks like, it looks like it's a one shot where they, like, go around the house and go inside and stuff. It's literally the opening shot in Black Christmas. It's identical. Like, it's genius. Like, I mean, and they obviously, I'm not going to say that Halloween is more popular than Black Christmas necessarily, but it definitely is more like iconic. You know what I mean? Like, so for them to take so many things from this film and get a lot of credits, really interesting, like, way to look at history. And I don't know. I just think Black Christmas did so much first.
I'd say it's similar to The X-Files and Twin Peaks. Like, more people have heard and seen of The X-Files, but not as many people would know that Twin Peaks was the inspiration behind it.
Oh, that's a really good comparison. Yeah, it's like one of those things where people who know about Black Christmas, like, know about it, and it's obvious, and it's like, oh, yeah, it's iconic. It did all these things. Like, you know it, but it's very cult following-y, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
Definitely. So I'm going into a little bit more of this article that talks sort of about slasher films in general and Black Christmas. And so they're quoting the director from Exorcist here. So William Friedkin, the director of The Exorcist, once observed that the audience's engagement with a horror movie begins when they're standing in line. Fear is generally something that is behind you, he says in an interview in the book Dark Dreams, A Psychological History of the Modern Horror Film, which I need to read. It's generally something behind you that you cannot see, but that you can feel, like a loud sound or someone touching you suddenly, or it's something behind the door that's about to be opened. So the fear generated by a slasher film is really powerful because it inhabits everyday spaces, which should feel safe. Is that something you'd agree with?
Definitely. That was even one of Wes Craven's one of the motivating factors behind Nightmare on Elm Street. In your dreams, you can't run away.
Yeah, that's really interesting, the way you think of like a safe space and like something that's comfortable for you and like feeling like you felt like you were safer in your house. And I think they've toyed with it a little bit. Like even in Black Christmas, there's a scene when the people knock on the back door or the back window or whatever, and like they're totally freaked out. And I think the line is something along the lines of like, this is the only door in the whole house that's locked. Like they recognize that for the first time. They're like, oh wow, like we should have like probably been locking our doors, like, which is such a 70s thing. I mean, you know, that's such a, like, now I feel like that wouldn't work in a movie really, but like I feel like in the 70s it's such like a, you ever watch true crime and the police are like, this was a town that nothing bad ever happened in, people left their doors open.
Yeah, every little small town story or true crime, like, we, this is the kind of place that we don't lock our doors, we don't lock our windows. It's a safe little hamlet away from the big city, right? They're not policed the same. I've watched a lot of true crime and done a lot of research and investigation.
I also think it's interesting that you said they're not policed the same, and I think this movie touches on that super well.
It really does. And that's a good tie-in. Like when we think about that deputy at the front desk, and he does get made fun of by the actual police detectives later on in the film because of that joke with Barb spelling out fellatio.
It's a new extension.
As, I think their phone number extension or something like that. Yes. Yeah. So this port, he's the Humpty Dumpty policeman, right? Out in the sticks of wherever this college campus is, which is super interesting. But that's another thing that gets touched on, even in some of the remakes, just like policing in general, how seriously are they going to take this? And then it also kind of comes back to, how seriously are like women taking when they're reporting some kind of a complaint. And that does come up in some of the later remakes, especially the 2019 remake. I'm not going to give anything away, 10, but like this is just, it's interesting because I do think there are a lot of touch points on women throughout this film. And I actually think all the women in this film, except maybe save Claire, are pretty strong characters. And individuals, but Claire, we only see her for a little bit and then we see her for the rest of the film as a dead person. So it's iconic, right? But Claire seems very waify to me because I never really got an opportunity to know her.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. And I really want to talk about the women in this movie like a lot, and I think it's super important to the plot, but I will forget this if I don't say it now. You kind of made me think about it. I think that like everyone makes fun of Sergeant Nash in this movie, but I think that they're giving Lieutenant Fuller way too much credit. I love John Saxon, incredible, his acting's great, I'm a huge fan, but like he does a lot of stuff really wrong in this film, like so much stuff. And even in the end of the film, obviously we're spoiling it, they don't even get it right and they leave the killer in the house. Like he messes right up over and over again. And like, I just wanted to say that before we went too far, that like
who doesn't do a full investigation or sweep of a house even after you think you've caught the killer, right? Like talk about the fact that they, you know, Jess is alive. They bring her upstairs. They sedate her. They sedate her and put her in bed. And then everyone leaves. There's just a cop posted outside the house, from what I can tell. And the killer's still up in the attic.
And two bodies are in the attic.
Right. There's two more bodies in the attic they haven't even found. Like, who doesn't do a sweep? It's like they don't know the attic is there, even though there's a very clear alcove with stairs or like a ladder.
Yeah, Alistair, you were saying they left a cop outside too, like even before, and that didn't work.
Yeah, the killer got to them. Like
that cop got murdered.
Oh, super murdered.
Oh man, this yeah, but I mean, let's break for that then. Like we should, Ten, if you want to talk more about the women and the female characters in this film, like let's dig into it a little bit because we're going to go through the whole plot and walk through the film. But I really want to get into some of these things because I thought it was a really interesting representation of women at the in that time period. They're very fully formed characters, except for maybe Claire.
Yeah, no, I totally think it's super important to this film, like the whole like idea behind the whole thing, honestly. I think I read online before, because I read a little about the film just recently for this podcast, but I think I read that, I think I read somewhere that when they were writing it, like Bob Clark was like, these women like aren't gonna act like that. That's completely ridiculous. They're like literally college students. Like they're gonna have like, you know, personalities, and they're gonna like have intelligence, and they're gonna have these things. It's kind of frustrating to think that, you know, Bob Clark, you know, had to be the voice of that. But, you know, at the time, I'm, you know, it's grateful looking back that they had that there was able to be like a little bit of a voice for like pointing out things like abortion and the way that the police look at the women and the way that they're treated like on campus, and just like the way that the guy's father is like, or the main girl Claire's father is like, you know, opposed to her lavish lifestyle or her party lifestyle very clearly. There's a lot to be said in general, but I don't, you know, that's such a long discussion that I wouldn't even know what
it's maybe it's something we need to, maybe it's something we need to write about at some point in time.
Ooh, I'm in.
I think it's interesting. And there actually is a book. I will read this excerpt from the article here that Black Christmas is often left out when discussing iconic slasher films. Carol J. Clover, in her landmark treatise on gender in horror movies, Men, Women, and Chainsaws, does not mention the movie at all, which is unfortunate because I think that these roles are, they're interesting, they're well portrayed. It does touch on a lot of things. Even the discounting of the mother of the 13-year-old girl, when she first comes in, she talks to Nash, of course, and Nash is like brushing it off because she's a 13-year-old that's supposed to be home after school or whatever. As Christmas break has started and she's not home on time, but she's a very good girl. She always does, you know, she's always home on time, and they're not being taken seriously. And now, of course, we have things in place where you can't report things for 24 hours. That really frustrates me, because then we find this, you know, 13-year-old girl dead in the park in the middle of winter. And I think the assumption is that it's the same killer, but I actually think there's two different killers operating in the area.
Whoa. Where'd you get that?
Yeah, what? I thought it was all the same killer. They walked through the park to get to the house. I figured that they killed that girl right before the murderer got to the house or something.
So that may be the case. However, the night that they find the 13-year-old girl saying that she disappeared earlier that day, it's a different day from when Claire disappeared. It doesn't happen on the same night.
But he could have been leaving the house, because he does go outside and kill the
now,
cop.
That is the scenario. So he could be leaving the house. The only thing is that we, from his perspective, never actually see him leave the house. That is what leads me to believe that there are two different killers operating in the area.
Also, it could be.
Also, that's the beauty of it. If he did leave the house, how would we know?
We'd have to see it from his POV. Like, he must be leaving the house. He can't just be up in the attic all the time, but he's moving around the house. We know that. So the other option was Peter. At least we're meant to think it's Peter, right? Which it's a possibility. He's becoming unhinged, right?
I hadn't considered that Peter actually was a killer. Genuinely, I love the ending, because there's a lot of like unansweredness, but it's also a little bit frustrating because you're left wondering if Jess knocked him out, or, well, he died. They said he actually got killed. They said that, but like, did she kill like her like boyfriend? Did she kill Peter, or like, or did something else happen? Was the killer there? Like, it literally doesn't show us what happened. And then like, she's passed out and they're like, I want to ask her some questions. And they just completely assume that Peter was the killer. They didn't even find out for sure. They just leave her. Like, and so like, did she ever see the killer? Like, cause there's that scene where he grabs her by the hair. Like, did she see him? Why was she so suspicious of Peter? If she was that close, she probably could have known it wasn't him, but like, still in the basement wasn't sure, was still like uncertain. Like, it's very, very unclear in the end.
He did break through the window, which implies, you know, there's some violence there, and he was, you know, angry.
Now, I don't believe, here's my thing with Peter, is that Peter is clearly over time a time bomb ready to go off. And it's just one thing after another building up for him to potentially have a psychotic break in an episode of some kind that could lead him to a single killing. However, I don't think Peter could be a serial killer. So that is the reason that I could attribute the girl in the park to Peter, but I don't necessarily. But it leaves it open to speculation and possibility, especially because he does become what seems more violent or aggressive as the film goes on. There's a lot of things that we could speculate about Peter, I'm sure, but let's jump into the plot. So I want to go over the plot points and then talk about it a little bit as well.
You're kind of blowing my mind. There could be a whole subplot there I didn't even realize.
This was literally just me on my last watch through, which was about a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks ago. And I was watching it and it felt even more tense because there's a tension set up in the film, which is, I think, why there's such great tension in Halloween when we kind of compare the two, because of the things that it borrowed from this film.
What I particularly like about the tension and like the questioning in this film, and a lot of slashers do this, not Halloween though, is they do like kind of, because they don't show the killer, they almost have this like Yallo kind of style where like you're led to start believing that you might like, oh, it could be one of the characters we know. Like, it could be Peter. Like, it could be, for all we know, it could be her boyfriend. Doesn't seem like him, but you know, like, you know, there's a lot of like loose, like, because you don't ever see the killer like for so long. Like, so I really like that actually in this film. Like, now that we're talking about it more, like realizing like there's so much unaccredited. I mean, hell,
I think
like,
it's a lot more effective than how it's done in Halloween. I definitely agree with you there. I always think it's more interesting for me personally as a viewer, the less is more tactic of what I can't see. And I think that the Amityville Horror, Margot Kidder is also in, the Amityville Horror is a perfect example of that, because the original, there's a lot that you don't see that you have to imagine. And then when you get to the remake later on, you see everything. They show you everything with like Jody and things like that. So what you have to imagine or can't see is like always going to be more horrific. And I that's something I love about horror films, and the ones that take that into consideration and use that like in artwork, that negative space to fill a different kind of void.
Yeah, like now that's almost stepping out of too. Like, I was thinking a lot along the lines of like plot, like even just like knowing like the whole time in Halloween that it's Michael Myers. You don't ever question it. You know the whole time that it's him doing the killing, and it's still scary, of course. But then like in a film like this, like Black Christmas, you don't know. And there are a lot of films, like I said, I know I mentioned Yallo, that's probably because it's my favorite genre, but like that's what I love about it. Or even like in Scream, you don't know the whole time. Like, you're left with that like, oh, like who is the killer? And I think a lot of you know, like Friday the 13th did it that way too, where you kind of knew after the first one. The first one you didn't know, but after that, like, they took that away and you kind of know. But it's interesting to think about it in plot, and then also in visuals, like the fact that it's POV, the fact that you only see the eye, the fact that like it's showing you not the entire murder. You're like left questioning, how did that person die? What happened? You know, where did they put the body? Like, what, you know, you don't see any of those things. So that's really cool that it's kind of a tie-in for both things.
I think one of the things I wanted to go back and look at with that sequence in particular, where you see just the killer's eye, is that if you look closely and then you zoom in on a frame with Peter in it, they have different eyes.
That's
it can't
fair.
Be Peter.
But I mean, I'm picturing like 1974.
But it's fun to speculate that it's Peter.
Yeah,
but
no,
I think
course.
That's a significant scene when you just see the eye. It's super scary. You don't really know who's behind there, but that's intrusive and really frightening. And I just like to, from an investigative perspective, go back and compare the two. But in terms of how the figure looks or how I imagine the figure is, or when we see shadow and things like that, especially when Barb is killed, for example, the silhouette of the killer does very closely resemble Peter. And that's why we're meant to believe it's Peter, right?
Yeah, no, I definitely see that.
However, what guy in the 1970s did not kind of resemble that silhouette?
The hair. I love that. I was going to say, too, that eye, that like that shot with the eye. I think about like iconic horror franchises or films that used like similar shots. And the one that came to my mind first was like Texas Chainsaw. But I was just thinking about this when you said it. I think that was actually the same year, 1974. I think that they were about around the same time. So I guess they weren't necessarily influenced by each other, but they could have been influenced by like Psycho or something. I just wanted to say one more thing about Bob Clark and how much he influenced. My last comment is that I think that Brian De Palma gets a ton of credit for like split screens and like things like that. And I completely see that. He did it so well, and he did it iconically in Carrie and Phantom of the Paradise and Dressed to Kill and everything. But I just want to say that like, even though there was a couple shots before these ones that have done that, this came out the same year as Phantom of the Paradise. It came out before Carrie, it came out before Dressed to Kill, before Blowout, and before all those other movies that De Palma did. And I could believe that De Palma was partially influenced by like seeing such like there's some split screen shots in this movie. There's one where they're like at the Christmas party and stuff. And I just think Bob Clark was really, really ahead of his time, to the point where his movies didn't get praised until later. And I just thought it was relevant to our conversation before we moved on.
Well, I'm going to walk through the plot, and y'all feel free to jump in anytime. But just kind of going through, this is a little bit more of a play-by-play of what happens in this film. So an unseen man that we still don't know the identity of, even after watching the movie, climbs the exterior of a sorority house where a Christmas party is being held and enters the attic. The house phone rings, and Jess answers to discover it is an obscene phone call from a person who has called before. Jess calls the other sorority girls, and they listen as the caller rants in strange voices. So this was interesting to me because speakerphone? Anyone? On a house phone?
Yeah, I mean, I assume that, yeah, because it couldn't have been that loud. It's
like
really loud.
I was like, okay. So Barb insults the caller, who in turn promises to kill her. A younger student, Claire Harrison, suggests that the caller could be dangerous before returning to her bedroom. And this is, I think, ironic. The point where Barb insults her or like embarrasses her or something like that.
Yeah, she makes a comment that's really inappropriate there about like a girl, like she makes a really, really inappropriate like rape joke, basically.
Yeah. So and this is, so Claire is the, I think, the quintessential virginal character. And the super interesting thing, because we go back to things like Scream and we talk about the rules of a horror film, and Claire is the first one that dies.
Oh, I didn't even think about that. Yeah, usually it's the other way around. Virgin survives.
And it doesn't technically say she's a virgin, but she's very much like the good one of the main characters.
Right, I think she symbolizes the
absolutely
virginity trope. But the interesting thing is, before, you know, Claire and this whole phone call happens, Claire is with a boy that she's been seeing, right? And it sounds like they're making plans to go away together. And like that might be the first time that they consummate their relationship. At least that's kind of the vibe that I picked up from the whole situation.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Now, I was going to say, to be fair, there aren't tropes in 1974 of this. Like, it doesn't exist. So, I mean, it wasn't like they were shattering it necessarily in 1974. But it's cool that like such an early film doesn't follow that.
Right. And I just feel like we can look back and say like, oh, well, this didn't happen here. And yeah, the tropes didn't exist yet. And that is something that Scream talks about because that's influenced by Halloween. They don't even talk about Black Christmas and Scream. Jumping back into it. The intruder. So Claire goes up to her room to pack. The intruder suffocates Claire with a plastic dress bag and moves her body to the attic. And then we get to see Claire in this rocking chair with a bag over her head for the rest of the film. It becomes an anchor point.
Iconic. Iconic.
Right.
Really interesting first kill, too. Pretty violent.
Yeah. The following morning, Mr. Harrison arrives to pick up his daughter, but she fails to show. Jess explains to her boyfriend, Peter, that she is pregnant and planning to get an abortion, which angers Peter, and they agree to discuss it later. And in town, Mr. Harrison attempts to report Claire is missing, and then at the police station, they learn that a young local girl has also vanished. So maybe this is all occurring in the same day. It just feels like it's different.
But, you know, you did say that it, well, because, like, it was only 3 or 4 hours at the time, because they're like, is it really that late for her to be missing? And she always comes home by noon. So, like, technically, if the girl was murdered, it would have had to have been after Claire was murdered. It would have been the next morning, like, during the day.
So he would have had to leave the house if it's the same person. I still suspect that there's two killers operating in the same area. I'm not going to lie. And part of that is because when we think about true crime and we think about not necessarily like motives, but the way a killer will, like a serial killer in this case, will select their victims, it would be very odd for this killer to leave a house full of, well, not full of, because a lot of people have gone home, but where a lot of potential prey exists, to go and like find more.
I mean, you could even theoretically argue that there were two killers in the house. They just don't show them at the same time.
That's an interesting theory. We're going to have to get into these later.
So I was just saying we could.
But yeah, so there's a young girl that's vanished. Clara's vanished. There's a lot going on in this tiny podunk Canadian town. It doesn't even talk about this whole turtle sex thing. It just goes into, after putting a drunk Barb to bed, Mr. Harrison, Chris, Jess, and Phil help search for the missing girl. They all go out with the search party in the middle of the night to find this missing girl. So meanwhile, the house mother, Mrs. Mack, or Mrs. McHenry, Mrs. Mack is short for Mrs. McHenry, discovers Claire's body, and the killer throws a crane that is hanging from the roof of the attic for some reason into her face, which hangs her and kills her, which this is a very complex kill. Because he's just holding back this like giant meat hook, essentially, that's hanging from the attic for some unknown reason.
Do you think the whole time he's thinking, no way this is going to work? No way. No way. And then he throws it.
I mean, I feel like it could knock her out for sure, but actually like penetrating her skin and killing her, just visually, I find it a little hard to believe. But that was really the one kill that I was like, eh, I don't know.
I think he was probably thinking like, Billy's going to do it or something creepy. Like, right. I think the hook might have been used to like lift stuff into the attic.
Maybe
like they had installed the lift stuff. But even then, I've never had
a house with an attic. So I'm kind of like, what? I don't understand what this hook is for.
I have, but none of them had hooks.
Yeah. And this is very reminiscent of, like, I guess, like, it maybe an East Coast town or a place that has more basement or attic space. It's not super common over on the West Coast where I grew up.
Plus, it's in Canada.
It's also in Canada, right? So in the park, the missing girl's disfigured body is found by police. Now, they say that here, but was that a comment that the police made at some point? Because I know that, I think, was she dismembered or something like that? She was mutilated, I think, but I don't recall specifically anyone calling that out. Just that she was dead.
Yeah, I don't know if anyone said it. I mean, they showed us like everyone's reactions.
We don't
like
actually
horrified.
See anything. They took out all the violence. Jess answers another obscene phone call and decides to file a report with the police, only for Peter to surprise her. And he attempts to persuade her into marriage, but she refuses and reaffirms her decision to have an abortion. So Peter leaves angry while Lieutenant Fuller arrives with a telephone lineman to bug the phone. A phone tap.
Yeah. So that seems important, though, because Peter says the line about removing a mole or whatever, or like removing a wart about the baby.
Yeah.
Which they say on the phone later. That's like when they're fighting.
The killer's in the house. Like, he could be listening to every conversation you have.
Oh, yeah. No, he says verbatim. And that's why I think that it's like because he's listening. But the girls don't know that. And so when they right. like, oh,
it's a red herring for us, same though. Thing.
Yeah, I know it is. Definitely.
Which is great.
Hello? Hello? Who's there?
After the police leave, the killer murders Barb in a like this is one of my favorite murder scenes. So Barb gets killed with a glass figurine. I think it's a unicorn.
It was a unicorn, yes.
While Barb is like drunk in bed, and Jess experiences another unnerving phone call in which the killer restates her argument with Peter. Which you just talked about. And then Lieutenant Fuller calls her to say the attempt to trace the call failed and theorizes that Peter could be responsible, but just doubts this. And then Phil is murdered next. So Phil goes looking for Barb, opens Barb's door, walks in, and then is grabbed by the killer, but we don't see anything else. So we're going to get into like an interesting point in the plot where Jess gets another phone call in which the killer alludes to some sort of transgression between two children named Agnes and Billy. So the Billy thing comes up a lot. Like, so we talk about no motive, right? Like, but at the same time, if you really listen to these phone calls, there's a scenario that's playing out between Agnes and Billy, wherein I think we're meant to believe that the killer is Billy and Agnes, he's projecting this character of Agnes onto Jess.
That's pretty interesting. I don't think
that was from the last time I watched it.
Okay. I don't think that in the movie they really ever explain it at all. But like, I know that like people call the killer Billy all the time now. Like that's what he's referred to. But like, he's not in the credits. He doesn't have a name, and it's never actually said in the movie. I don't think. I mean, from my knowledge.
No, they don't. They don't. This was me. This was like me kind of making this distinction based on the last time that I watched it and really listening to the phone calls and hearing everything that the killer has to say. And when he starts to sort of have this, I want to say psychosis almost, he's disassociating with the Billy and Agnes thing. It's super interesting because it reminds me of like the Norman Bates character and Mother. I'm just trying to analyze it. Okay, so the killer and the killer's backstory, it is a bit of a point of contention here. So I did find an interesting fact that although the audience never finds out anything about the mysterious killer, or even if his name is in fact Billy, director Bob Clark worked out a backstory for the character. He was abused as a child, locked in the attic, and eventually he killed his parents. The Agnes character that Billy keeps referring to was his little sister, whom he tried to kill, but she escaped. So this is what gave Billy his dislike of women. These elements were actually incorporated into the 2006 remake of Black Christmas, which I have not seen yet. And that was all done with Bob Clark's approval. Yeah, it's something where we don't ever figure it out or what it's about or if it's about anything at all. It could just be another ruse, but it's interesting to analyze it and try to figure out how it actually ties into who the killer is and their personality and things like that. So the call is long enough to be traced this time, and Sergeant Nash instructs Jess to leave the house immediately. So is that correct, Sergeant Nash?
Yeah, well, so like, and that's the scene where the lieutenant calls Nash because he's at the music school and he just found the broken up piano and stuff. Mm-hmm. So he calls Nash and he's like, which is the bad sergeant, the one who's like not doing a very good job of helping anybody. And he's like, oh, you have to tell her to leave, but you can't mess it up and don't tell her that the killer's in the house and don't say anything. Just tell her to walk out the door and I'll be there in 5 minutes.
He had
don't
one tell job. Her right. He right, had yeah. one job.
He had one job. I mean, to be fair, he does his job, but Jess doesn't listen.
Nash!
Yes, sir.
Look, I can't get through to Jennings. I want you to calm that girl. Nash, be calm. Don't tell her that the guy's in the house. Just tell her to put down the phone and walk straight out the front door. I'll be there in 5 minutes. And Nash, if you blow this, I'll kill you.
Phil? Phil, where are you? Please answer me. Hello.
Who is this?
It's Jess.
Miss Bradford, this is Sergeant Nash. Are you the only one in the house?
No. Phil and Barbara are upstairs asleep. Why?
All right. Now, I want you to do exactly what I tell you without asking any questions, okay? No questions. Now, just put the phone back on the hook, walk to the front door, and leave the house.
What's wrong?
Please, Miss Bradford, please just do as I tell you.
Okay.
I'll get Phil and Barb.
No, don't do that, Jess. Jess, the caller is in the house.
The calls are coming from the house.
Jess,
get out. And don't go up there. Don't.
Bradford. Phil! Bob! Oh, please answer me!
So Jess gets another phone call in which the killer alludes to some sort of transgression between two children named Agnes and Billy. The call is long enough to be traced, and Sergeant Nash instructs Jess to leave the house immediately. All the calls are coming from within the house. Concerned for Barb and Phil, she ventures upstairs where she discovers Barb and Phil's bodies. They're just like laying on Barb's bed. It's a very not really a gruesome scene, though. There isn't a ton of blood or anything like that. The killer appears and pursues her. This is where we get that kind of iconic like shot of the eye, just the eye. And Jess locks herself in the cellar, only for Peter to appear outside of the windows. He smashes the window and enters the basement. And this is where things get kind of tricky and interesting. I don't think there's any way that the killer could have made it down to the basement. But we don't know exactly where he was. But it's hard for me to also think like, well, if he was in the basement and then the police barged in, I guess we don't know exactly how much time there was between. So does he like go back out the basement window that Peter smashed and then like crawl back up the trellis?
You know what,
if he was in the basement?
I think that we hear the scream die, I think that it shows the police outside and you hear her scream. So I think they're literally outside when it happens.
Okay, that's what I thought.
And then they like bust the door.
So we're not under the assumption that the killer's in the basement, right?
I don't think that they're led to believe that. I mean, we could, you know.
Well, the killer was trying to get through the basement door that she had locked or blocked, and then you hear the killer stop banging, and then shortly after that, that's when Peter went through the basement window.
Okay, great, because I thought someone had mentioned something about her hair being pulled.
Oh, that happened. Yeah, when she's being chased by the killer.
Okay, but not when she's upstairs. In the basement.
No, it's before she gets to the basement. Okay. But what I meant by that was like, did she not see the killer like when he came down the stairs and grabbed her hair? Like she still didn't see him and then she still ran into the basement. Like she didn't turn around. And so like, right. That's what I thought was interesting, because like, where is he like physically like behind a staircase or what, like where she didn't see his face. And then to, so then she still suspects it's Peter when she goes downstairs, even though like she kind of just could have just looked at him. So it's like a little bit like, you know, cause it's camera angles. So I'm like, what did she really see? You know,
that's a good question. And we don't know because she's been sedated.
Exactly.
Maybe she only saw a silhouette similar to what we see over Barb while Barb's being murdered. But the police arrive and hear Jess screaming, and they discover her barely conscious in the basement with Peter's bloody body next to her. Believing that Peter was the killer, they put Jess to bed in her room and leave her alone in the house with a cop standing outside. The killer's voice is heard from the attic, implying that he is still alive. The still undiscovered bodies of Claire and Mrs. McHenry are seen through the attic window before the telephone house begins to ring again, leaving Jess's fate ambiguous. So this whole scenario is like super interesting because like I just don't understand. It's like, yeah, she's going to be asleep for a couple hours, but wouldn't you normally, even in a hospital, like even in the 70s, post a cop outside the hospital door, not outside the door of the hospital itself?
It's pretty goofy. I don't see why they even left her at home in the first place.
Like, yeah, she should have gone to a hospital. Maybe she's in shock.
Like, what? You don't know? Like
yeah, what? There was a doctor that just sedated her. But, I mean, what Canadian town are we in?
Oh, also, the father of Claire, he had passed out. I think that kind of distracted them.
Right.
Oh, but you know what? I get what you're saying, though. There was someone in the room with her, and he was going to be there, too. There was going to be two people. And then the guy who was in the room takes Mr. Harrison to the hospital.
Right. Everybody leaves the room to attend to Mr. Harrison.
Even though they were like, he was just going to stay there. Where was he going to go? Like, he had nowhere to go. So like, I guess they weren't actually planning on leaving her by herself originally.
And on top of that, they thought it was Peter who, you know, we assume is dead. So
he's dead.
Okay. So they're thinking she's safe. You know, we'll talk to her later.
Still pretty wild.
I agree.
Yeah, I guess if you don't assume the danger is imminent anymore, what would you do?
Search the whole house, find the other bodies,
search the
hospital.
Yeah,
she passed out. You
still
don't
search
even know
the house because you don't know. Like any good detective, which we like, Lieutenant Fuller is not apparently.
No, none of them are.
Would search the whole house from top to bottom, like not only to see, like, because you know you would have had to search the house to find Barb and Phil because Jess was like barely conscious. So why would you not also search the crawl spaces, the attic, etc.?
Especially with people missing,
it's going to be something that gets to me forever.
Yeah, it's pretty goofy. It doesn't, it just continues that same plot. The men are, like, in this movie, most of them are just, like, problematic, and they don't respect women, and they make dumb decisions, and the police in this movie, time and time again, aren't unhelpful, and I think it kind of just, it continues that through the end. They're just like, and still didn't help. Haha, it's still like not solved. Got you. Like, you know, it's pretty solid. It's not, what I do like about it is it reminds me of like the jump scary trope that you got like later on in horror, but it's not a jump scare. It's just like, but the killer is still there, but it's still like the same vibe, you know?
Okay, so before we move into sharing some fun trivia about the film that you may not know, let's talk about the body count. So there are 8 deaths in the film that we know of, I believe. And this, I think, is also counting Jess in that mix. So if we believe that once that final phone call starts to ring that Jess has been murdered, then I believe the kill count is 8, but let's go through this. So the kill count includes Claire Harrison, Mrs. McHenry, the unseen character Janice, the girl who died in the park, Barb Cord, Phyllis Carlson, that's Phil, Officer Jennings, Peter Smythe, and Jess. So we count Jess in this body count. So Peter was the only victim in the film that was not murdered by Billy, because we assume that Jess killed Peter. At the end of the film, Claire and Mrs. Mack's bodies are still undiscovered, and although it is arguably ambiguous, the ringing telephone, an event that occurs after each murder, implies that it is the killer calling once again with nobody there to answer it, at the end of the film, and the only other person in the house other than the killer is Jess. The implication is that Jess is murdered by Billy just before the credits begin to roll. And because we never actually had a sequel to Black Christmas, I think we can consider the unconscious Jess part of the body count. Okay, so let's talk about some interesting facts. So after seeing the ending of the film, studio executives had asked director Bob Clark to change the ending. The proposed idea was to have the cops leave Jess alone with Chris, Claire's boyfriend, and she'll wake up and he says, "Agnes, don't tell them what we did." Then he kills her, but Clark refused and kept his original ending. I think it would have been really odd to have Chris be the killer. Like, never crossed my mind for a second that Claire's boyfriend, Chris, was the killer in this film. And every scene where we see actress Lynn Griffin is a scene where her head is wrapped in this plastic bag. She actually is wearing a plastic bag over her head throughout the entirety of this film. And she pokes some like pencil holes in the nose area and like sucks the bag into her mouth to make it appear as though like she's suffocated in the bag. And it's really, really interesting. And apparently she was actually a swimmer, so it helped her to hold her breath in the bag. And a lot of fans regard this film as the first film to come up with the popular convention of a killer calling from inside the house or utilizing that urban legend. However, it was preceded a year earlier by a film called The Severed Arm from 1973, in which a radio announcer is called repeatedly by the killer, who the operator soon discovers is inside the studio on another phone. And then the TV film Mousie from 1974, which featured star Kirk Douglas terrorizing ex-wife Jean Seberg with calls that the police eventually traced to a room upstairs. There's dialogue between the police inspector and Seberg, and it's almost identical to that between Jess and Sergeant Nash in Black Christmas. So both likely set the precedent for this convention popularized by Black Christmas in 1974. So it's also said that there were several attempts over the years to produce a sequel for the film. After the failure of the remake, Bob Clark began work on the sequel before he tragically passed away in a car crash in 2007. In all of these attempts, Olivia Hussey and John Saxon, who played Lieutenant Fuller, were to reprise their roles of Jess and Lieutenant Fuller, respectively. Jess would have to become the new house mother of the sorority in Clark's treatment for the film back in 2007. Unfortunately, that never saw the light of day due to his untimely death. So, I mean, that's still definitely something that I think could happen at some point in time. I hope they give it a shot. Now, if we go with that scenario, of course we go back and we got to change the body count to 7. So and apparently you notice how we see Claire rocking back and forth. Apparently Bob Clark was off screen rocking the chair that Claire's corpse was sitting in with his foot whenever they would shoot scenes in the attic to make it even creepier. Aha. And also, while shooting the scenes of Claire's body in the attic in the rocking chair, the cat, Claude, ran across the floor, and Bob Clark was inspired to add in the moment of Claude crawling on the corpse and licking her face. Ironically, getting the cat to actually crawl on her was tricky, so eventually the director had to just be off camera and physically throw the cat onto Lynn Griffin. Here's another interesting fact about the film, and this goes back to what I had to say about the ending of the film. So, though the film ends rather ambiguous, with Jess laying in bed and her ultimate fate unknown, while Claire and Mrs. Mack's bodies are still undiscovered in the attic, it is worth noting that Mrs. Mack told the sorority that she was returning home for winter break to visit her sister, who was expecting her. So her sister would certainly call the sorority to inform them that she never showed up, warranting a more thorough investigation of the house. Furthermore, the original mono track has a line of dialogue in the background where the police officers state that investigators are heading over to look through the entire house for evidence. They would never skip over the attic, especially if there already isn't a decaying smell from their bodies. Although it is really cold, and it's only like Claire was killed the night before and Mrs. Mack was killed earlier that day. So there's a chance that there isn't that much decomposition yet. But let's get into our bloody knife ratings. So bloody knives, you've got 5 of them, similar to Letterboxd, where you might have 5 stars. Tell me how you would rate this film and why.
I'll wrap it up. Why? Here, my opinion and why. 5 bloody knives, 1 for each kill. I'm kidding. 5 bloody knives, because it's cinematically interesting to watch. It's really like a really cool time stamp of like the 1970s in Canada in college. It's a really, really empowering and has a lot of really interesting issues in it involving police and women and like college kids and like the changing of times and like just generational changes. It's terrifying. It's so scary. I know people who I will watch this film with that just the voices on the phone, it creeps them out. It's intense. It's genuinely unnerving. The score has this great appeal to it with these weird sort of stringy sounds. The acting is superb and phenomenal, and the sets are wonderful, and it's iconic, and it's inspiring, and it's influential. And if I had to write a list of reasons why not to give it 5 bloody knives, I don't think I could, because I think this film deserves all 5.
My first initial watching, I kind of regret because I had it on in the background, so I wasn't able to get a lot of the little details or see a lot of the nuances in the performance. So my first initial reaction was 4, but after having rewatched it a few times, I definitely give it a 5. And it still holds up to this day. One of my regulars watches horror movies like all the time, but she had never seen this one, and she said even this one, a almost 50 year plus movie, she said this one really disturbed her. And all the performances, like, I feel like you could go to a party and see these people, like see like people with those personalities, and you know, just a lot of performances. Like, it doesn't feel like anyone's acting. Like, it just feels like there's a camera there and you're just watching what's happening. Which, of course, just goes to show you how incredible these performances are. So, definitely. So, 5 knives.
I'm going to agree, especially on my last viewing of this film. I gave it 5 out of 5 bloody knives. And I think that beyond what it did for what is now the slasher subgenre of horror films, the film was even more impactful to me this last time that I watched it. It felt much scarier. It was extremely tense, and it left me with so many additional questions. And I like being able to revisit a film and discover something new. That is all I had for today. So thank you, Alistair and Ten, so much for being here to talk about Black Christmas with me.